Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
I'm Rebecca Lavoy, and this is You Can't Make This Up. You Can't Make This Up is the podcast where we uncover the true stories behind your favorite Netflix documentaries and films. On today's episode, we take a closer look at the Netflix documentary, What Jennifer Did.
And a guy was there, and he came at me and tied my arms back and said, I have a gun behind your back. Do what I say. If you do what I say, then no one will get hurt.
Today, we're talking to director Jenny Popplewell and producer Paul Nguyen. In 2010, police in a quiet Ontario suburb received a frantic 911 call. A woman said she'd been tied up by intruders who just shot her parents. With her mother dead and her father clinging to life, Jennifer Pan gave detectives gripping descriptions of the home invasion. Investigators had no idea why the Pans had been targeted, but a closer look at Jennifer's life made them rethink what they knew about the case. The Netflix documentary, What Jennifer Did, looks back at the high-profile crime that shook Canada. The film uses police interrogation footage and testimony from those involved to unravel a web of complexities that no one saw coming.
Yes, we know criminals aren't that smart some of the time, but I don't think that they could get this whole plan mixed up and kill the wrong people. Total bullshit. She set this whole thing up.
And I'm joined now by director Jenny Popplewell and producer Paul Nguyen. Welcome to You Can't Make This Up, Jenny and Paul.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi.
So, Paul, we do begin with this dramatic 911 call. Can you talk about that, like what we're hearing in the 911 call? What did you think when you first heard it?
Well, it's, a shock to me. You know, she's reporting it to the police and they're taking the call and it's a lot of urgency. It's emergency.
911, your call.
Help me, please. I need help.
Ma'am, calm down. What's going on?
Some people broke into our house and they showed all his money.
Ma'am.
But later on, when you see the interrogation footage, you realize, you know, that Jennifer is an unreliable narrator. We don't know whether she's speaking the truth or lies. And so everything is put to question. So to find out later on, you know, the extent of her involvement in this case and to contrast that with the beginning, the emergency call, it was a shock. I've read online the reactions like she deserves an Oscar for her performance.
I think about the 911 call. It's, again, to have a moment captured. Jennifer's ready to make this call. And partway through, Han wakes up. And I think it's captured that moment of realization for Jennifer that there's a survivor, that her father is alive. And there's the panic in her voice when she shouts, you know, I'm calling 911, I'm calling 911. That moment is, again, captured in audio. So I think it's key moments have been captured on camera or on audio. You know, he wasn't awake and then she called 911. He wakes up during, he comes to life during her call to the police.
I'm curious, you know, we get the highlights of those three separate interviews with Jennifer in the documentary in which she tells the police her story. How much raw video was there of those interviews? Did you have to go through all of it?
Yeah, there's about 10 hours of raw interview. And we went through all of it. The detectives go round in circles, obviously, and you know, she'll be halfway through telling one story and then they'll circle back, which is a technique that all investigators use when interviewing people. So it was about curating that material so that it was easy to understand for the audience to organize the material together and the elements that she's talking about when she speaks about Daniel, that's then all gathered together. Or when she's talking about her parents, that's organized together. But yeah, there's a lot of material to go through.
So Paul, when you were listening to Jennifer talk, especially in her first interview, I'm wondering what struck you about how she carried herself, you know, what her affect was. You went into this story, I think, knowing more about it than, you know, I did when I was watching the documentary. So I'm curious, knowing what you knew, what was it like watching that and what struck you about it?
Well, my reaction, you know, upon seeing the footage and knowing what I knew is very surprising. Because I think her demeanor looked very calm. There was like a confidence in this testimony. I think many people were surprised that she thought she could get away with something like this, and that the police were initially, you know, believed her testimony. But I think later on, you know, it just wouldn't have held up.
There's moments where she's very upset, clearly. And the detectives have told us, you know, that she's a victim of a crime and she's a witness. So they're being very delicate and very careful with her, even though they have questions. You know, it is alarming. Why is she tied up, and why have they left a surviving witness? They're not in the world of crime documentaries. Not every story is going to have some crazy twist. There's often things that happen at face value. She's got a victim liaison officer. Deborah Gladding has been assigned to her. They're worried if she can give this information, and they've asked her to come straight from the hospital. She's just lost her mom and her dad's in a coma. So it was a delicate interview, that first interview.
Well, I want to hear more about the actual victims of the crime, Han and Big Pan. What kind of people were they, Paul? I mean, what's your impression of them?
Well, from the testimony from Hong Ngo, she said that they were, you know, kind people. You know, they cared for their daughter, obviously, especially, you know, if they're providing education and paying for all these lessons and just trying to, you know, want her to excel. So from all accounts, we'll never really know what happens in the house because, you know, no one can speak for them, you know, from the outside. And from the feedback that I got, you know, just going online and seeing people's reactions, like a lot of people were really divided, and some were like, oh, well, the parents cared for her. They took care of you. And then this is how you repay them. Like, it was a shock. And other people kind of sympathized with Jennifer for her case and can relate to feeling those parental pressures and affecting the mental health. And that could be a serious problem as well. So, you know, both sides were very divided.
But Jenny, I mean, if the thought is that the home invasion was about money, it seems like the Pans were financially comfortable, but they weren't the wealthiest people on the block. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. As Jennifer says, understand, they're comfortable. They've paid their house off. They're living to their means. They're working very, very hard. They're here to provide a better life for their family. And they're very focused on, you know, being providers and making sure that their next generation is able to have all the opportunities that they didn't have. And they've worked these jobs. You know, they've worked in a company called Magna, a car parts company. They've worked really hard and saved. I don't think that they, other than that car, I don't think that they were spending a lot of money on other luxuries. I think that they were focused and driven. And I think it didn't look to the outset, to the detectives, that it was financially motivated, because money was left in the house. The safe was untouched. They didn't take their wallets. It's more like when they look back at the photos, they turned the house up, you know, the mattresses were over. You could see that it had been turned upside down, but valuables had been left behind. So it didn't seem that they were targeted for their money.
Paul, you said that you were from Toronto as well, but what is the community where they live? What is that community like?
Markham has a, you know, a larger Asian population, Vietnamese, Chinese background. I would say it's considered a more affluent part of the GTA, which is like the greater Toronto area, surrounding areas. And yeah, so it's like a, you know, single detached home, double garage. They have two luxury cars. I mean, yeah, they're a little bit more than comfortable, I would say, you know, depending on your perspective. But in that community, Markham is not known for crime.
They were just really quiet people. They didn't bug anyone. Yeah, it's really sad.
The randomness really scares me. It's, you know, if there was a motivation, if there's reason, you know, then we can all say, oh, they had the reason why.
It's actually very quiet, peaceful. People go there to hang out, go to the mall. It's a very beautiful neighborhood. So when something like this happened, it was a big shock to the community.
Well, I do want to talk about Daniel Wong. We can come back to him and his motivations in a bit, but their relationship, I mean, it was a long-term relationship, but it started when she was quite young. Jenny, can you tell me about the nature of their relationship? I mean, they were together, but it was a secret from her parents, right?
Yes. They don't meet until 2003. She's very young. They go to Europe and she's studying there. It's like a music course, and they've gone on this music trip. And she has said on the stand that he kind of wrestled, well, she says it actually in the interrogation room, She says that people were smoking nearby and she started to have an asthma attack and Daniel saves her. So there's kind of this savior story and a romanticized element of Daniel from the moment he enters her life. I think he's exciting for her and she's just very drawn to him. And they keep their relationship a secret. We have heard that her parents did know about Daniel because he used to play paintball with her brother. And it was known that he had an issue with dealing. So it wasn't just that he was working, you know, as a Boston Pizza guy that was the reason for them not supporting the relationship. They hadn't heard great things about Daniel. So they didn't approve of that relationship. Their relationship was on again, off again. It was quite a volatile relationship in that respect. He tells that story about the paintball gun. It felt like Jennifer was always very interested in Daniel and trying to get Daniel's attention. And Daniel was a little bit more aloof, which is potentially why she made such grandiose gestures for him and spent all her money on him. And Nam says, why didn't you spend some of it on yourself? Or why did you spend it all on him? And she said, because I couldn't think of anyone better to spend it on. So I think she put him on a bit of a pedestal.
Well, we do hear in that second interview with Jennifer, there is this picture of her that's forming. She talks about the relationship with her parents. She talks about, you know, how she was deceiving them. She went to tremendous lengths in this deception, and it started early. Like, it started relatively early. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of the lengths that she went to, because it seemed like it started quite young. This is not something that started like a year before the crime, right?
No, her grades began to slip in 2001. She starts forging report cards in 2002. She dates another boy called Adrian in 2003, and it's not till later in 2003 where she meets Daniel Wong. So her grades have already slipped and she's already forging report cards. Now, that's not desperately terrible behavior. I'm sure many children have faked an A or a B. That's Paul is nodding. Paul agrees. This is not unusual. And obviously, it's in this web of lies and deceit where her moral compass must take a spin, and that's where she ends up. You know, she's a 14-year-old child. There are expectations to be the best, and I don't think those expectations came just from Bic and Han. I think, you know, her piano teacher says to us on camera he was expecting her to be the best. She was the best, but he was expecting her to be brilliant. Her teachers had said, when we've interviewed people, they've said, you know, we wanted more. It wasn't good enough for her to be a B or a C grade. They want her to get A's. I just think that is a lot of pressure, and it's wrong to just point that she can't happily coast. She's expected to excel. But I think in that those early stages of a 14-year-old faking her report card because she's failing, I was actually quite sympathetic to that.
Yeah, you know, I was too. And Paul, I saw you nodding vigorously a couple of times there. I mean, something that people say sometimes about kids who have behavior like this is that they begin lying because they're afraid to tell the truth, right? Can you weigh in on that a little bit about, you know, those pressures and what you think that she may have been going through?
So yeah, there are those pressures. I don't think it's just parental pressures, but also with your neighbors and peers at school, especially with a similar background. And I think, yeah, the parents make it worse because they're going to compare you to this person or that student. And how come you're not doing as good as them? So yeah, it's very difficult. I was nodding because I don't know if I want to say this, but guilty as charged. Faking
same.
Report cards.
Paul, same.
Yeah. So
it makes you feel any better.
I was pretty good in the graphics programs. But I think that speaks to a larger problem. And it was just the fear of dealing or confronting with the parents and just lack of communication. But I think things are a lot better now. People are getting more open, and especially mental health is more talked about now and more accepted. Back then is a very taboo subject, especially amongst Vietnamese. So I hope a film like this can encourage people to come to the table and, you know, just appreciate your parents, appreciate each other and have that open dialogue so these things won't happen.
So I'm curious, you know, Han Pan did survive his wounds and came out of his coma. So what did he tell police about what happened when he woke up?
When Han woke up, I don't think he didn't know what Jennifer had been saying in her police interview. He knew what he'd saw, but also that might not have really fully appreciated what he was seeing. It could have been Jennifer speaking in a soft voice and kindly to them because she's frightened or she's cooperating. He didn't fully understand what was happening. And it's not until other family members continued to visit him in hospital where they were also reporting to him about odd things Jennifer was saying. Now she was living with them back in their home.
Mr. Pan tells me that he was on the couch being pistol whipped. Mrs. Pan was sitting in a separate couch begging for her life. And while this is happening, Jennifer walks down the stairs in the company of one of the suspects. She's without bindings on her hands and appears to be in friendly conversation.
So he actually spoke to David McDonald, who's the detective in our documentary. Hans does not describe the same men that Jennifer describes. Bill Cortis, the lead investigator, was very interested in being involved in this documentary because for him, this case isn't closed. There is somebody that went into that house, a third person. They believe they know who that person is. They don't quite have enough evidence to charge this person, but this case will always remain open for them, and they'd be very interested to catch the person that Han described to them.
So one of the things that was interesting to me was in the third interview with Jennifer, you know, they bring in this new detective who claims to be an expert in truth verification, basically a human lie detector. And, you know, my criminal justice mind is basically like, there's no such thing as a human lie detector. Did that perk up your ears too, Paul, when someone claimed to be a human lie detector?
Well, if you're not familiar with the legal justice system, and also now if you're in the further interrogation and attempting to cover one's tracks, I mean, I think some people can believe those kind of things. And especially if you're under pressure, you're juggling with multiple storylines in your mind. That was that.
Yeah. Yeah. I found myself wondering, I mean, this is a two-part question, so I'm going to ask the first part first. And Paul, the how is answerable. The why is always more difficult to answer. And there are people who say, yes, you know, I understand the financial motive, but, you know, maybe a child couldn't possibly have their parents murdered just because she finds them, you know, difficult, or because they disapprove, or just because she wants their money. It's obviously like a bigger issue going on here. But like, how do you think this all happened? Like, and how does she get so many people involved in this crime?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for Jennifer, and no one else can except for herself. But in my own experience, and I can relate to those kind of pressures of just not wanting to disappoint my parents, and very fearful, but not fearful in like a physical aspect, but just fearful of, you know, just having confrontation, and the criticisms can sometimes be harsh, and it can be very painful and hurtful. You know, it depends. I think the people you associate with can lead you down that kind of path. And, you know, if you're having access to certain people, then definitely those options could be available. So it's, I think that maybe she got mixed up with the wrong people, and that contribute to it.
Hmm. What do you think, Jenny? Because this was quite a big conspiracy. I mean, what was in it for all of these other people? I mean, I also have questions about what's in it for Daniel Wong, because I understand that their relationship was troubled as well, and yet she was able to get him to participate too. And that's something that really confounds me. I mean, do you have any understanding of that?
Like Paul, I can't speak for why any of them do. And I think this is another element of the title. It's what Jennifer did. And I don't think anyone's ever going to understand the why Jennifer did this. And that probably extends to her co-conspirators. It's why? Why does anyone kill anyone? I think the why is going to mean something different to everybody else. And I think this will be a different viewing experience, depending on your lived experience. So some people will watch this and have a very straight down the line opinion and say, Jennifer was evil. How could she have done this? And then there'll be other people that watch this documentary who obviously won't say that she should have killed anyone. That is wrong. Nobody should have lost their life. Bix should still be alive today. But there will be people that will see the nuance in her experiences and empathize with what she's saying in that room, and will start to see the gray to this black and white. But I think what is important is that it will spark discussion, and it will have people being more open and talking about life in the home and how what happens when we stop talking. As Paul mentioned already, that how important mental health support, and how Paul told us that it was it's kind of a taboo, or it was many years ago, 2010, when this happened, that Jennifer probably and unlikely had access to talk about mental health. And she was sharing her feelings with Daniel. He's her confidant. He knows how she's feeling. And instead of directing her to support or saying, like, we need to get you help and this isn't right, or let's have an intervention, or anything needed to happen. And instead, he gave her homeboy's phone number. And I think that's the tragedy here, is that when she does reach out to someone, she does share her feelings, rather than to steer her in the right direction and show her that she's going about this in the wrong direction. And I'm not suggesting she is not accountable for her own actions. She is not an innocent bystander here and a puppet here. But there is definitely, it's interesting how it's always levied against Jennifer as the own, you know, Daniel's involved as well. He's in that room pretending he doesn't know what's going on. And
the last few that I received was bang, bang, bang.
Okay, so let's That's important.
Yeah.
Right? It was a message?
Yeah, it was a text message.
Oh, it was a text.
Bang, bang, bang. Ha, ha, ha. This is some pretty messed up.
Yeah, pretty messed up stuff, yeah. Right?
Detectives in the film speculate that it was financial for Daniel, that he knew that he had some control over Jennifer. He knew how forlorn she was for him and would do anything for Daniel. She was always at his restaurant bringing him lunches, following him to events, giving him money, buying him presents. And through their research, they found that the money that Han had paid Jennifer, an amount of that money went to Daniel. So I think he was potentially financially motivated. He says in his interview, the parents hadn't intervened, that they might still be together and he doesn't know. But I do think it was a big deal for him that they didn't approve of their relationship. And I think that's why he was with Christine for 2 years. So I think this is why he potentially was moving on from Jennifer. And I think Jennifer felt that. She felt she was losing Daniel and he might never come back. And that text message where he says, I feel about her the way you feel about me, I think was devastating to Jennifer. She couldn't understand it. She says on the stand, she doesn't understand how he could have developed these feelings so quickly for Christine. So I think she was trying very hard to maintain this relationship. And Han gave her that ultimatum, pick Daniel, pick us. And we can't conclude for sure, but it looked like Jennifer chose Daniel.
So I was really surprised to read all the media coverage and conversations around this case online and how sensational a lot of it was. It really surprised me. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the issue that we found when we spent a long time researching this documentary. We've spoken to many, many people over the years that knew Jennifer. There are people in the documentary that knew Jennifer. We've spoken to detectives that are involved in this case, as well as the ones that aren't on screen. And the big issue that a lot of people had was what's reported about Jennifer is kind of come from Jennifer on the stand. And people have chosen to believe what Jennifer has said on the stand or has said in that room, filled in the gaps and made up a new narrative. We didn't find a lot of what was reported about Jennifer to be true. We were speaking to people about Jennifer at Christmas jams. She was at semi-formal. She's been at house parties. People that waited with her, multiple people were saying, oh yeah, she's been out on work-related socializing on nights out. We know she was the first person to get a BMW, a white BMW. She was giving her friends lifts. She wasn't this prisoner in her home that people have reported that she was. What the detectives found, and
to be clear, by the way, Jenny, that's also what it says on her Wikipedia page. Her Wikipedia page says all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's not what we found through our research. Now, obviously, it's tricky to then show that through multiple people that do not want to speak out about this case anymore. But what we did in the documentary is we stick to the facts and just told the facts rather than explore what's said online, talk about that and then stand it down. But yeah, we kept finding a girl who had been out a lot, had been to parties, had been to events, was socializing with her colleagues, was driving and giving people lifts to evening classes. This valedictorian that she was dashed, as she says on the stand, she felt she would have close hopes of being valedictorian. And when that moment's dashed, that's her unraveling. This wasn't true. Her multiple classmates were saying, nowhere near going to be a valedictorian. Wow. So it seems like Jennifer has told a story to her parents, or Jennifer has told a story, as we saw multiple stories in her interviews, but she also continued that on the stand. And I think it's dangerous if you pick and choose what to believe Jennifer is saying and then report some elements of fact because it tallies with what you think her experience must have been in that home. I think that's a disservice to Bic and Han and their parenting. And I'm not suggesting that life was perfect in that house, and we don't know what happened behind closed doors, and nobody should be commenting on what happened behind closed doors.
Yeah.
But to fill in the gaps and suggest things as fact because Jennifer has told us, I think is dangerous. We didn't do that in this documentary because that we couldn't find anyone that correlated or corroborated that fact. And the detectives told us outright, no, that was not true. We did not find, Jennifer was lying when she said that on the stand. So
that's incredible. I just want to say that's incredible because this is, by the way, and I did enough reading to know that there is so much contradictory information out there. And when you read about this case and you talk and you read the media coverage at the time, Paul, especially like the Asian media, I saw some of the translated Asian media there. This was a big part of the narrative. And it is really something. I mean, were you surprised to find out that so much of what was reported and so much of what's out there on the internet as fact is basically not true?
Well, yeah, because I mean, many people whoever are commenting are probably not directly involved. So, I mean, they can just be like armchair commentator. That's why we kept it to like having the detectives themselves, the investigators, speak directly to the facts of their investigation and stayed away from that conjecture, guessing, you know, sensationalizing things that there's no researcher to kind of support that.
We did fact check other elements and did find other bits to be true. So Jennifer was dropped off to piano by her father, and Fernando, who's in the documentary, confirms Jennifer was brought to and from her lessons in the last few weeks, in the last few months before her parents were shot. He does say that she breaks down to him and says, my parents, they don't approve of my boyfriend, which was her focus, not my parents are pushing me to be a Olympic ice skater or making me do math homework. It was about Daniel. This is what she was upset about. And I think Bill Gates, the detective, said this is what he saw. He saw the parents did actually find out that she had been lying, and they followed. She said she was volunteering at Sick Kids Hospital and they followed her there because they just didn't believe her anymore. They'd caught her out in fibs before. And it's only then when she was caught out in multiple lies where she kept saying, no, I'm not seeing him anymore, or I'm now volunteering. It was just one lie after another. And they were getting loans for her. They bought her a laptop. They paid off Daniel. They gave Daniel money to say, like, she said she owed Daniel money. If they pay him off, we do not see him again. They basically equated Jennifer's spiral. You know, she hadn't even graduated high school. They had so much hope for her and she had so much potential that they were worried that her association to Daniel was bringing, you know, her life was spiraling. Once they uncovered everything that she was doing, they then said, make a choice, pick Daniel or us. But if you live here, you need to not see him anymore. And she chose. She said, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to cut him off. And that's when she started contacting Homeboy. The extreme version of Jennifer's testimony on the stand and what's been reported, we kept again, time and again, kept running into people that said, no, that's not true. That's not true. No, I went to this party with her. No, I was on that night out. No, she wasn't going to ever be anywhere near Vela Victoria. Skating coaches are saying, no, she's not, definitely not good enough to be
an Olympic hopeful.
To be Olympic hopeful. She's also, they're saying she wasn't working into the late. They were saying, oh, our ice rink shut at 7 p.m. She wouldn't have been doing, she says on the stand that she's studying. She finishes ice skating at 10 p.m. and then is studying till midnight. Again, this isn't true. That ice skating rink even said to the time that they closed it, they closed at 7 p.m. There was just time and again, we couldn't match what Jennifer was saying on the stand or what had these theories that had started to circulate about her. You come to the first person, you start interviewing people and just doing your fact checking, and it was never matching up. So we really struggled. And that's what's interesting about Jennifer's story, is to remind the audience when they're watching this, we have gone to her as first person. We're not interviewing other people to give theories on what they think was happening behind closed doors or what they think was happening in Jennifer's life. We go straight to source. It's Jennifer who's going to tell you what's happening. But you have to remember, she is an unreliable narrator. So right. Up to you to decide what here is true. And that's what the detectives had to do. And we want the viewer to fall in step with the detective and decide what they think they believe or not. And I think they conclude pretty well at the end, you know, having looked through her diary and what they say about her parents wanting her to not have her life ruined by Daniel. I think they were fair to her parents in a way that perhaps the media hasn't been as fair to her parents. I'm not saying we don't know what happened behind closed doors. And I'm not saying she had a perfect childhood either. But what I'm saying is I don't think the media has been kind to Bick and Harm. And time and again, we have found inaccuracies.
So, Paul, you know, given that Jennifer is an unreliable narrator, I have to ask, I mean, she didn't participate in the documentary, but if you had the opportunity to speak with her, you know, she's unreliable. You can't ask somebody, you know, if they're innocent or guilty and when their legal case is still unresolved. She claims that she's innocent. Is there something that you would have wanted to ask her, or do you think that an interview with her would be worthwhile knowing that she's such an unreliable narrator? I'm just curious on your thoughts about that.
Interesting question. I think if we were to pursue, and if she was in a new interview, I think it would speak for herself, because you would be able to contrast that with the facts that the detectives uncovered. And whatever she says, it would just support the facts that have come out already. So if she's continuing through a certain narrative, and what we know what happened or what the detectives discovered and what we learned through the research, I don't think that she can escape it by providing any specific new narratives.
I mean, that's the hard thing here, is it's dangerous when you decide to pick and choose when Jennifer is telling the truth and when she's lying. Same on the stand, same in those interrogation rooms. We are listening to her and having to decide, like a jury would, like the detectives are, like her parents did, having to decide when Jennifer is telling the truth and when she's not. But having listened to multiple interviews with her now across those interrogations. I did find it quite compelling listening to her talking about, she opens up to Bill Gates in that third interview. And it almost feels like this might be the first time she's had a very deep and meaningful and open conversation about how she's feeling.
So tell me about the piano. When did you start with the piano?
When I was four.
Wow. Yeah, I took it in grade school too. I still remember Swans on the Lake. Didn't know how to play that, that's about it. Now, your parents. Do you ever feel that it's pretty tough to live up to their expectations?
Yeah.
I get that feeling, that maybe you weren't as smart as what they thought that you were.
Yeah.
She describes feeling like everyone's leaving her behind and she's such a disappointment. I mean, everyone's moving on with their lives and she isn't. That felt very authentic to me. And again, we'll never know because it would be wrong to pick and choose what to believe from Jennifer. But we've presented it and it's up for the viewer to decide whether what they believe from Jennifer's testimonies, interviews.
Well, the documentary is What Jennifer Did, and there's a lot in there for the viewer to make decisions about. I can attest, I've seen it, and it is fascinating. Director Jenny Popplewell and producer Paul Nguyen, thank you so much for joining me to talk about it. It was a really great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks again to director Jenny Popplewell and producer Paul Nguyen. For more of my takes, check out my other podcast, Crime Writers On. Each week on that show, we break down the latest in true crime documentaries, TV shows, podcasts, and pop culture. If you like You Can't Make This Up, please rate and review this show and share it with your friends. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to follow the show to stay tuned for all new episodes. You Can't Make This Up is a production of Netflix. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Thanks so much for listening.